From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what Michigan needs to safely send some workers back to their jobs.
People need to understand about when we say we've hit a plateau is that it's almost like we hit this peak and then we're just sort of staying at that peak.
Also today, one emergency room doctor in Detroit talks about what's different these days in her workplace.
You know, it has changed it a lot. We are not seeing as many patients with heart attacks and strokes come in, and a lot of us don't really know why.
So is that less frequent emergencies or patients who don't want to risk being near infected people? We also touch base on the health of the lakes. While attention's been elsewhere, regulators have loosened up.
And there's a lot of stuff that is just, you know, flying under the regulatory radar, which is leading to degradation of our Great Lakes.
Those stories and more just ahead on today's episode of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, we're going to be speaking with a Detroit emergency room physician about searching for answers to the coronavirus.
There are hospitals doing randomized controlled trials with different medications, hydroxyquinone, for example, but the actual medication or the best way or the most ideal way to manage these cases is still unknown.
But first, as we heard yesterday, there's been much conversation in Lansing about whether some Michigan businesses can safely resume operations. What exactly does safe even mean anymore when even our hospitals are struggling with issues of hygiene and physical distance? And how much does the epidemic have to subside for leaders to feel okay about sending workers back into action? Michigan Radio's Kate Wells and Will Callen have been looking into this, and they join us now. Kate, Will, welcome back.
Hey, April.
Hey, April.
Guys, we're hearing all the time that things have leveled off and we've hit this plateau. And yet, I feel like we keep seeing more and more new cases reported by the state every day. What exactly do we mean when we say that Michigan's hit a plateau? I mean, we're not out of the woods yet, clearly, but what's changed?
Yeah, so I think what people need to understand about when we say we've hit a plateau is that it's almost like we hit this peak and then we're just sort of staying at that peak. And we have two indicators for that, right? You've got testing and you've got hospitalizations. I feel like hospitalizations are some of our best indicators right now. And remember sort of at the beginning of this where you just saw that big curve going up and up and up of more and more people being hospitalized. It's sort of like about 2 weeks ago, really the beginning of April, it hit this peak. It sort of stayed there. And for even some health systems like Beaumont or Michigan or Henry Ford, it's even started to sort of slowly trend down. People are still really, really sick. You know, that doesn't reflect how many people are in the ICUs or on ventilators, but they're not being completely overwhelmed the way that they were initially, and they're being able to sort of say, okay, we've hit this plateau. The other place where we've seen sort of a general plateau is in testing. And remember, testing is like totally imperfect because it's not universal yet, so it doesn't tell you everybody who's sick, and it doesn't tell you when somebody got the virus that specifically. But again, back in early April, it's like we were adding about 1,200, 1,300 new cases from the state every single day. And over the last few weeks, we've pretty much stayed in that range. And of course, this is when everybody brings in the but, right? So this Henry Ford Health System was giving a general update about this, and their CEO of their medical group, Dr. Steve Kalkanis, was also like, that ends if we stop social distancing.
The stay-at-home orders, the social distancing, all of the significant and unprecedented steps we took as a society have successfully led to this plateauing. If you suddenly reverse that, then you could really put really all of us at a risk for going through a second surge.
It feels, Kate, like experts in Michigan are looking hard at this. How do you start to return to normal life without creating that severe second surge? Do you know anything about how they're attacking that question?
Well, so there's how lawmakers are attacking it, and there's how experts are attacking it. And the experts that I've talked to say you essentially need to have three things all at the same time, like three prongs here, a three-pronged approach. You need, one, phased-in social distancing that we're hearing so much about. So like, April, if next week or whenever I return to the office and you and I are both at the office together, but then the other week I work from home and Will comes into the office. And that's because you want to be able to do the second prong well, which is contact tracing. You need a massive statewide ability to say, okay, so Kate is sick. Who did she come in contact with? Well, she was in the office with April. And then, of course, the third thing you need is universal testing.
Always the testing. It seems like what we come back to again and again. So where are we on this? Folks might have missed our chat yesterday with Michigan House Speaker Lee Chatfield. Will, could you recap what some lawmakers are proposing to restart certain sectors of the economy?
Yeah, sure. So just to be clear, the proposal is pretty preliminary. It's not comprehensive, but basically what it's saying is that you would assign each county in Michigan a certain risk level, and you'd start letting those areas deemed less risky, you'd start letting them ease up on restrictions sooner and in more force. So in broad strokes, what that would mean is that you would maintain more restrictions and for longer in Southeast Michigan and maybe start loosening them up north a little bit sooner. But as Kate was just mentioning, you know, in order to know that it's safe to do any of that, we need to increase our testing capacity, and we also need to start getting out and doing this contact tracing, which, you know, requires time-consuming investigation. So as for the testing capacity, in the last week, the state has expanded eligibility criteria for getting a test. So now, if you just have mild symptoms, you can get a test. Or if you're an essential worker reporting to work in person still and you don't have symptoms at all, you can also get a test. And then as for contact tracing, again, this is just starting up, but the state has expanded eligibility criteria for the testing, but that doesn't mean that our testing capacity, the number of tests we're able to give, has increased necessarily.
Yeah, that's an important distinction. Let's say for a moment that Michigan does experience another surge. If things reopen too soon or if businesses don't have adequate protections, would it look any different than what we're going through right now?
Well, first, to be clear, the severity of a second surge is going to relate directly to social distancing, whether we continue to adhere to guidelines and for how long. So the more that we adhere to the social distancing guidelines, the smaller the second surge is going to be. You know, cases generally go up about 2 to 3 weeks after social distancing drops off. So we may see that we ease some of these restrictions, and it's going to take a while before we see the effect of that. There are two main things that we want to be looking out for if we do start easing some of the restrictions. One has to do with drug supplies. Drugs like sedatives and painkillers and anesthetics are really important during this pandemic because they're required for ventilator patients. They make patients who are getting intubated comfortable. It's completely agonizing to get intubated if you don't have these drugs. And, you know, because of the pandemic, there is a huge surge in demand for them. So right now we're only seeing, according to some estimates, like 53% of orders getting filled. We heard from the Beaumont pharmacist that 3 weeks ago, that hospital system was down to a 48-hour supply of these drugs like sedatives and painkillers. And so what they did was they got all of their vendors together on an emergency call, and luckily were able to get those emergency shipments delivered before that window closed. But the problem here is that vendors and wholesalers, they're not required to report their inventory levels to the FDA. So we literally don't know how many of these drugs that they have unless they're voluntarily reporting them. So we don't know if they have what it takes to bail out another large hospital system if there is a big second surge.
Oh my gosh. You know, I feel like I've heard this narrative in some form before. We've chatted from time to time with a University of Michigan medical historian about second waves in the 1918 flu epidemic. You guys are aware of his work, right?
Yeah, so Howard Markel, he's a doctor and a medical historian at University of Michigan, and he published a study in 2007 looking at non-pharmaceutical responses to the 1918-1919 flu pandemic. So stuff like we're seeing now, school closures, quarantines, public gathering bans. And they compared 43 cities to see, based on when they imposed the restrictions and for how long, how those cities fared in the long run.
We found that cities that did them early, that did more than one, they layered them in a way that was very effective, and did them for a long period of time. Because social distancing doesn't cure a virus. It doesn't really prevent you from, if you have contact with the virus, of getting sick from it. What it does is buy you time.
So obviously there's a big difference 100 years later. We can't make a direct comparison between now and 1918, but the point still stands. We have been imposing multiple restrictions here in Michigan. We've been enduring them for a long period, and we're probably going to have to endure them for a while longer in order to give medical professionals and scientists time to care for patients and develop a vaccine.
Michigan Radio's Will Callen. We also heard from reporter Kate Wells. You can read more of their work online at michiganradio.org. Guys, thank you both very much.
Thank you, April.
Thanks, April.
Physical distancing has meant so many things to many people. For some, it's a chance for self-reflection. For others, it's more time at home with the Pringles. For Michigan Radio contributor John U. Bacon, it has meant a decision about a long-term goal. He had been planning to run the Boston Marathon on Monday. Obviously, that was canceled. So he made his own physically distant marathon course through the streets of Ann Arbor and ran it on Sunday with a few friends and family cheering him on. You can hear him talk about the experience with Morning Edition host Doug Tribou. It's on the front page right now at michiganradio.org. John, congratulations and everything. But maybe you could put some of that speed and endurance to a truly useful end. Could you bring me a sandwich? A lot of things have been happening while we've all been preoccupied with health and safety. For one thing, the health of the Great Lakes has become less secure.
They're allowing levels of pollution to be released into the Great Lakes without then following up and asking, you know, what happened here? Was there some sort of an accident? Was there some sort of anomaly?
In a moment, we'll hear how the lakes have fared under less stringent oversight at the EPA. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. If your interaction with the Great Lakes is weekend getaways, beach or river walks, or maybe a day boating or fishing, it's hard to see how these beautiful, massive bodies of water are changing. The eyes can't necessarily tell whether they're cleaner or dirtier hourly or on a day-by-day basis. A new study out of Chicago shows the past few years of regulatory rollbacks within the Environmental Protection Agency have been death by a thousand cuts. Many small changes and polluters are taking a toll on our lakes. Nick Schreck is Associate Dean at Detroit Mercy Law School and an expert in environmental law, and he joins us now. Nick, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
What did we learn in the study?
Well, basically, this was the Environmental Law and Policy Center out of Chicago. They looked at a lot of reports that are publicly available, but they're very dense and confusing and not easily understandable. So the great thing that ELPC did was they looked at a lot of information around fines, so the amount of money that EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is levying against polluters. They also looked at how much money industry is spending to rein in pollution or to add pollution control technology regarding water pollution in the Great Lakes. And they looked at just the level of violations as well that companies are self-reporting for their pollution into the Great Lakes. So the ELPC compiled all that information, put it in nice, very to easy understand charts and graphics, and basically told the story that we are seeing a decrease in enforcement for pollution in the Great Lakes. We're seeing a increase in the amount of abnormal pollution events that are being reported by industries. And overall, we're just seeing a threat to the water quality of our Great Lakes if these trends continue.
Who are the main polluters that we're talking about here? What kinds of products are involved?
Well, in general, these are larger industries. So around the Great Lakes, we have very big users of water, meaning they draw in a lot of water and discharge a lot of water. So think of things like cement factories, steel mills, automobile manufacturing, you know, large industries, coal-fired electrical power plants also intake and discharge a lot of water. So there's many different industries all around the region that use a lot of water, and they actually pollute a lot of water. The other key thing to think about is wastewater treatment plants. So water that is discharged from our large municipal treatment facilities, those are also regulated, as well as with something we call industrial pretreatment, which is where many of these industries actually treat some of their own pollution before it's discharged into the Great Lakes. So these are, you know, larger facilities, but of course we also have smaller facilities that would perhaps discharge certain types of pollution. All sorts of chemicals, you know, ammonia, chlorine, et cetera, are things that are regulated that we want to reduce that type of pollution from getting into the Great Lakes.
Well, is it a surprise to you to, when the data is consolidated, to find that overall regulation has been in a downswing?
Well, it's not surprising in that the trend that we've seen from the Trump administration is that they are looking at regulated industries in a different way. They're trying to be more quote unquote business friendly. But what we see from an environmental protection standpoint, that often means decreasing the amount of enforcement actions that are brought, decreasing the amount of investigations that are conducted by federal officials. And so overall, that means that there's a more lax regulatory environment. And that encourages, you know, perhaps bad actors to pollute more than they otherwise would if they were being closely watched by the federal government. Or I think what is more dangerous is that they're allowing levels of pollution to be released into the Great Lakes without then following up and asking, you know, what happened here? Was there some sort of an accident? Was there some sort of anomaly? And there's a lot of stuff that is just, you know, flying under the regulatory radar, which is leading to degradation of our Great Lakes. So not overall surprising from my perspective as someone who tracks this type of stuff, where we've seen this rhetoric and this language coming out of the Trump administration, that they're trying to be more friendly to industry, more friendly to business. And that has harmful environmental consequences if we're not seeing the level of enforcement from our Environmental Protection Agency and our state environmental agencies that we need to make sure that our waters are protected.
What do the higher levels of pollution mean in terms of the life of the Great Lakes? I'm asking about things that we might see every day, but also the less tangible results that wouldn't be obvious without deeper study.
Sure. So there's some things that, you know, we've all heard about the algae blooms in Lake Erie. That's a result of pollution coming off of farm fields, primarily agricultural pollution, things like phosphorus and nitrogen that are organic pollutants that feed algae. They're like fertilizer for that algae and makes it grow. That's something that we can see very clearly. There's a lot of other chemicals that we can't see, and we don't necessarily know that a water is polluted just by looking at it. It may look perfectly clear, it may look crystal blue, but there's actually a lot of pollution that is within that water. And so these are things like the reason why we have fish advisories in the Great Lakes for Great Lakes fish is from mercury pollution, from the burning of coal, like coal-fired electrical power plants. And so you can't see that mercury. You couldn't actually see it there in the water or see the fish ingesting it, but then we can then still get that into our bodies by eating those fish. There are many other chemicals, things like fire retardants or PCBs, pharmaceuticals that get into our water either from discharge from a wastewater treatment plant or from what we call runoff, meaning when the rain or snow carries these pollutants directly into a river, lake, or stream. Those kinds of things, many of those types of chemicals we can't actually see. Some of them are even odorless, but they get in the water and over the long term can not only get into fish and aquatic life, but then they can get into our bodies as humans, either through drinking that water or through eating the fish, eating whatever seafood we get out of the Great Lakes. So that's the concern that we have, is that there's a lot of these chemicals that they may not look funny or smell funny if you're walking along the beach, but they're there, they're present, and we need to regulate them and reduce the amount of those pollutants that get into the Great Lakes, or it can have negative health consequences for us down the line.
I have a question about that. Is it possible that lake levels might have anything to do with increased pollution? Maybe more runoff and the water that is entering the lakes lapping up materials that otherwise might have been on land?
So here's what we know. With increased precipitation, that means more runoff. So when we have more intense rain events, storm events in the summer, higher amounts of water over a shorter duration, that runoff picks up pollutants and makes its way into the Great Lakes. So certainly from that perspective, yes. High lake levels, the other thing we worry about is shoreline erosion. We have many contaminated sites on the shore around the Great Lakes where if that soil, that dirt, washes into the water because of high lake levels, it carries with it whatever pollutants are in that soil. So a dramatic example here would be on the Detroit River. We had this shoreline collapse at a facility that there was a lot of concern about contaminated soil right there along the Detroit River.
Right. It was a former uranium plant.
That's right. They were actually processing uranium rods there back in the 1950s. So there was a lot of concern about what that meant for water quality. So that's just one example. I mean, the Detroit River is at all-time highs, just like many of our other Great Lakes. And so the real risk is shoreline collapse or erosion where you have contaminated soil, contaminated sediment that gets into the Great Lakes and can degrade water quality. Hmm.
The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative has been responsible for much cleaner water over the past decade. Do we know exactly how much has been lost from the Restoration Initiative just from this administration's enforcement or lack thereof of EPA rules?
So the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is actually a program that started under the George W. Bush administration, but it was not funded, meaning that the program was created, but there was no appropriation from Congress back then. Then under the 8 years of the Obama administration, there was money that was appropriated each year to work on things like wetland rehabilitation or habitat rehabilitation around the Great Lakes, giving grants to local units of government to clean up their processes to decrease the amount of pollution. So all sorts of really important work. Under the first few years now of the Trump administration, there have been attempts by the Trump administration to zero out funding for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. Trump's very first budget, cut all the funding for the initiative. However, through bipartisan work in Congress, they were able to restore levels of funding to the initiative. So we're still seeing I think it's around $200 million or so a year that's going into the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative over, I guess, the at least initial budget requests of the Trump administration where they were trying to cut that funding. So what we're also concerned about with these higher Great Lakes levels is, you know, a lot of this habitat restoration work that's been conducted may be impacted by bigger waves, bigger storm events. You know, if you're working on a coastal wetland area and that is now completely inundated by water, of course that work will have to be completed again once the lake levels go back down to their normal averages.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Nick Schreck, an environmental law expert with Detroit Mercy Law School. And we're talking about the health of the Great Lakes with a reduction in oversight from the US EPA. We've heard within recent days that Enbridge Energy has applied with the state of Michigan to move forward with the Line 5 tunnel construction project under the Straits of Mackinac. What should we know about this turn of the screw with Enbridge?
Well, this is part of the ongoing process where Enbridge is seeking to build that tunnel to construct it under the Straits of Mackinac. And we should point out that there's ongoing litigation, both in terms of the agreement that Enbridge struck with the Snyder administration right at the end of that administration, and then also over, you know, whether the actual easement that gives the authority of Enbridge to run the existing pipeline along the lakebed there in the Straits of Mackinac, whether that is in fact legal. So there's ongoing litigation, but as part of that, the Michigan Court of Claims ruled that Enbridge could go forward in seeking permits to construct this tunnel in the Straits of Mackinac. And so what happened was just a couple weeks ago, Enbridge did submit their permit application to the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy just a couple weeks ago. And they also have to get a permit from the United States Army Corps of Engineers. That's the federal agency that has jurisdiction over construction projects in the Great Lakes. What's concerning to many environmental organizations, as well as local units of government up in the Straits area, as well as tribal governments. The concern is that we have this application that came in during a stay-home order in result of the COVID-19 pandemic, and there's real concerns about public access to these application documents, the ability of the public to be able to comment effectively on these permit applications from Enbridge. You know, you can't have a public meeting in the middle of a stay-at-home order for people to learn about this proposal and to provide meaningful public comment. So EGLE has said that they are working on opportunities for the public to be engaged in this process, but it's very concerning, again, both from environmental groups as well as from tribal governments and municipal governments, that they're concerned that they will not be able to have an active role in this permitting process because of the situation we have currently with COVID-19. You know, all of this permitting and all of this activity is going on at a time when the public really can't be engaged in this process in the way that they normally would. And that raises some concerns about, you know, what type of involvement, what type of impact can the public have in this regulatory process of which we are by law supposed to be a part.
Nick, have you been able to get any sense of whether the regulatory and economic chaos of the pandemic and the tremendous amount of energy that really everybody is spending just figuring out how to perform regular work, is that having any impact on how EPA is functioning right now?
Well, I think it has to be. I mean, you have many people that are working from home, working remotely. These are federal agency staff as well as state agency staff that may not have all access to all of the files that they would normally be able to review in their office. So there can be some delays. I think we're seeing some non-essential functions of our government that are slowing down as a result of the pandemic. And that's understandable. I think, you know, from my perspective, one thing that our government could look at is, you know, delaying some decisions on certain permit applications. I mean, Enbridge is one example. We want to certainly make sure that the existing pipelines on the Straits of Mackinac are as safe as they possibly can be. But on the other hand, like when we're looking at new construction and new big projects that are likely to have an environmental impact, I think there's a question of whether we need to do those right away or if we can wait until there's the opportunity for meaningful public comment and public engagement in that process. So, like everyone else struggling to work remotely and work from home, you know, me learning how to teach remotely and teach over a video conference with my students, we're seeing the same challenges at our state and federal agencies. And so there will be delays. And I think sometimes, you know, delays might be a good thing. Let's make sure we get these things right. Let's make sure we appropriately involve the public as the law requires, rather than, you know, rushing through things in the midst of all of the other challenges and frustrations and stress that we have related to COVID-19.
Yeah. Is there any way for Congress to step in on this one? You mentioned before that it was congressional action that really kept the Great Lakes, that kept the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative alive. Do you think that they're going to be able to step in this time?
So Congress has incredible power to, you know, pass laws, to update laws in regards to protecting our environment. You know, we're coming up now on the anniversary of the first Earth Day, the 50th anniversary. You know, it's definitely an opportunity for Congress to look at our current regulations and our current environmental protections and see where they might be strengthened. You know, one thing that I would suggest is that the Congress, when appropriating money for relief programs related to COVID-19, that Congress, you know, think about the potential environmental impacts of that money. Basically, they can make some strings attached to that money. They could require, you know, certain types of renewable energy development. They could require large industries like the airline industry or cruise line industries to adopt more environmentally friendly practices as a condition of receiving federal money. And the same thing is true right here in the Great Lakes region. You know, we're going to have a lot of industries that are struggling that are going to need the support of us, the taxpayers, right? I mean, it's our money. And I think it's completely appropriate for Congress to put environmental conditions, meaning we expect this money to be spent in a sustainable and an environmentally friendly way, or you're not going to get it. I mean, I think that's certainly something that Congress can do and is well within their power. Bigger picture, and again, this kind of gets back to the whole Earth Day anniversary, you know, looking at whether our Clean Water Act is actually getting at these types of non-point pollutants that we've talked about, or whether our Clean Water Act needs to be updated and refreshed in a way to make sure that we have clean water for fishing, boating, swimming, and drinking on into the future. And those are all very appropriate things for Congress to be working on. You know, promoting health, promoting environmental health is, I think, something we can focus on in light of this pandemic. You know, we're only as healthy as our ecosystem is. And if we don't have clean air to breathe and clean water to drink, our immune systems can be weakened, and that can make us more susceptible to these types of diseases. So, you know, it's a great opportunity, I think, for Congress to be looking at the holistic approach to environmental management and to our environmental regulations to make sure that we're, you know, providing the best protections we can for our public.
Nick Schreck is an associate dean at Detroit Mercy Law School. Nick, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, more on the evolution of the Line 5 tunnel deal from a tribal perspective.
Let me say it in the words of the chairperson of the Bay Mills Indian Community. He said, "This is exactly what a comic book supervillain would do."
Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Tomorrow, Michigan's Public Service Commission holds a special meeting, online of course, to talk about Enbridge's application to replace and relocate the Line 5 pipeline under the Straits of Mackinac. It carries light crude and natural gas. Any number of people have a stake in what's happening here, and many of them have concerns about how construction and the pipeline itself will affect underwater ecology and safety throughout the region. The Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians has been deeply involved in advocacy around Line 5. Kathleen Brosimer is environmental director for the tribe. Kathleen, welcome to Stateside.
Hello.
So Enbridge put in its application for this state permit several weeks ago when, shall we say, many of us were otherwise occupied?
Yes. Many of us are finding challenges in working from home, staying separated from our coworkers, and in some cases separated by an international border, in my case.
What's your take on the timing for this?
I've been told that it actually was required because of part terms of the agreement with former Governor Snyder. I'm not sure about that. I think whether or not it was required, it certainly is. Well, let me say it in the words of the chairperson of the Bay Mills Indian Community. He said, "This is exactly what a comic book supervillain would do."
So tribal leaders have written a letter to the governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, asking her to slow things down. Has the governor responded yet?
No, not directly to the tribal leadership, as far as I know. As of late last night, I hadn't heard of any response whatsoever. I do know that last week she was asked at her presser whether she was considering this, and her initial response was that the Eagle staff are professionals and doing a good job, and I'm sure they are, and capable of handling the basic permit application. But the part of the permit application that refers to the general public and tribal consultation was not caught up in that, and I think she probably thought better of herself there, because she then segued to that she was going to consult with the Eagle director, Liesl Clark, about this and see what Director Clark recommended that they do. But I haven't heard anything since.
What's at stake here from the tribe's perspective?
The ability to be full participants in a very involved process. The tribes have participated for a good 5 or 6 years now in trying to ensure that the waters of the Straits of Mackinac and adjacent waters of Lake Michigan and Lake Huron are protected from an oil spill from Line 5, either at the Straits or along the 90 miles of pipeline that are in the U.S. 2 corridor in the Upper Peninsula, a mile or a mile and a half from the shore of Lake Michigan. There's a lot of chance for things to go wrong there, and we have been asking and demonstrating and demanding that the lines be shut down. We would very much like to be full participants in these permit processes. There's a rack of them. There's a number of them under Eagle and Michigan DNR. There's others under the Army Corps of Engineers. And there's a major one under the Michigan Public Service Commission that is the big concern at the moment, because that's a big case. That's a contested judicial case, which will go on for about a year. and will require, for us to be full participants, we will be needing to request intervener status. We will need to invest money in staff time and lawyers to follow this case and to participate and prepare testimony, and in fact to retain expert witnesses to prepare testimony. So it's an extensive proposition. And we want to be able to bring our best game to it. It's very important to us.
Are there specific challenges associated with the distance that we're all having to observe in the moment?
Oh, absolutely. One of the biggest challenges is that all the tribal casinos have, for the sake of their employees and their customers and the general public, have shut down. Tribal casinos are a major revenue generator for the tribes that they then invest in the social services that they provide to their members. So the health clinics that the Sioux Tribe operates. Sioux Tribe operates 7 different health clinics in the Upper Peninsula. We operate Meals on Wheels and other services for elders. We operate Head Start and other services for children and youth. A whole range of programs that are funded by the revenues from our casino operations. The casinos are shut down, naturally. It's a good thing, needed to be. But it does mean that those revenues are shut off. What a lot of people outside of the tribal community don't understand is that the small business infrastructure support programs that the federal government has brought in do not apply to casinos. So we are working, our tribal leadership are working very hard to try to get some sort of relief and help from the federal government so that we don't have to do more drastic things than what we've done. We've been working from home for a month now, and there's no end in sight to that. We're doing a call back to work on the 3rd of May if that date holds. But right now we are in a position where even trying to decide whether to put up an intervention request in this Public Service Commission hearing is a very difficult decision for tribes to make.
Are there technical or legal nuances that play out when hearings and permits are handled from a distance that are challenging?
Well, of course. I mean, it is definitely, you can read the room when you're presenting testimony. You can have your expert witnesses in the room presenting testimony. Cross-examination is an interesting phenomenon from a distance. We're all doing it now, of course. The courts continue and things have to happen. But this one doesn't. This one could wait.
Thank you so much for your time today, Ms. Brosmer. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Kathleen Brosmer is Environmental Director for the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians. Detroit continues to be one of the nation's hotspots for COVID-19 cases and deaths. Michigan is now ranked as having the 3rd highest number of COVID-related deaths in the country, despite the fact that the population of the state is only 10th. Grappling with a surge in critically ill patients, the lives of healthcare professionals are looking very different than they did just a couple of weeks ago. Dr. Charlene Babcock practices emergency medicine at Ascension St. John in Detroit. Dr. Babcock, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Could you give us a sense of what day-to-day operations look like at St. John Ascension's emergency room these days?
Well, we have seen a downturn in the volume of COVID patients coming in, which is a very positive sign and correlates with the flattening of the curve that we've also seen in graphs about how things are happening here in Michigan. But we still are seeing very sick patients. And I think I agree with the rest of the people that are experts in the area that are recommending people still stay at home and quarantine themselves at this time, because I think that that's really is helping to decrease the volume.
How has the outbreak of COVID-19 changed who comes into the ER right now?
You know, it has changed it a lot. We are not seeing as many patients with heart attacks and strokes come in, and a lot of us don't really know why. We hope that they're not staying at home and potentially having a stroke at home or potentially having a heart attack at home. We really don't know why, but we're not seeing the same type of volume that we had seen before COVID. And I think many people are very worried about going to the emergency room because of the potential exposure.
Are there aspects of the job that you feel like your ER was well equipped to handle as the infections began, and maybe some aspects in which the ER was less prepared?
Well, you know, when it first hit, I don't think anybody realized how quickly the volume would increase. And this has certainly been unprecedented in my lifetime. And I suspect we'll be hopefully the only time in my lifetime we'll see something like this. So clearly the volume ramped up extremely fast, and these patients were very, very ill. And as everybody knows, since this is a new and emerging infection, the ideal way to manage these cases was essentially unknown, and in many ways is still unknown for sure. There are hospitals doing randomized controlled trials with different medications, hydroxyquinone, for example, but the actual medication or the best way or the most ideal way to manage these cases is still unknown.
Are there some things you feel like you have learned in the past few weeks?
We have learned for sure that staying at home and making the population in general quarantine at their houses has definitely helped. We do know that some of our traditional mechanisms that we use to treat patients when they were intubated, meaning on life support, to improve oxygenation, we are now doing before we intubate them. And the classic example of that would be something called proning. Basically, when you lay on your back, which most people in the emergency department or when they're in bed often lay on their back, a lot of the fluid collects in the lower part of your lungs. But if you prone them or flip them over so they're laying on their stomach, then the fluid will shift towards the front part of the chest, and that frees up a lot more lung tissue in the back to receive oxygen and improve oxygenation of the blood. So even though in the past we would normally consider proning only in patients who were intubated, we are now doing it actually on patients before they get intubated in the hopes of preventing intubation.
At the start of the surge, you put a video up on YouTube that detailed a way to hook up more than one patient to a ventilator. And this was widely circulated. There were hospitals at capacity in New York and Italy that started using this method. Have we had to use this technique in Detroit?
To my knowledge, we have not. We've been fortunate enough to have enough ventilators at our hospital, and I believe in the other hospitals in the area. I have not heard of it being used here in Detroit. I have received some emails that it has been used in New York. And overseas, I know I had some contact with people overseas wanting to know how it was done and some information on it. I do know that there's a lot of different scientists looking at different ways to put more than one person on a ventilator. And in these different groups are kind of all spearheaded and communicating with each other. And I'm hopeful that they're going to come up with an even better way to do it than the one that I showed on the recording of the video.
May I ask, who taught you how to do that?
It actually started out with a research project with the PI, who is Dr. Greg Niemann. He was a resident at the time, and I was the research director. So he had a research project he was doing, and we worked it out, and we showed how you could do four people on one ventilator.
So that just came to your mind as a possible technique for making the more of less equipment when we started hearing about the spread of the virus?
So this research project was done way back in 2006. And at that time, I believe we were having issues with the bird flu at that time. Mm-hmm. And there was concern at that time about enough resources. And so Dr. Niemann had come up with the thought of, well, let's see if we can ventilate more than one person on a vent. I thought, that's a great research project. So we did it, and we showed that it was feasible. We did publish it, but it was a very small study, and it was only, you know, just using equipment, artificial lung, for example. But when we heard about people in Italy not having enough ventilators, my daughter actually called me, and she goes, Mom, remember you did that study? Don't you think that'd be helpful information? Maybe they can use it. And, of course, it was a very, very primitive study because it was only done using equipment that, you know, you could find in the emergency department. But I thought at the time it still might be valuable information to show how it is feasible. And that was the whole purpose of the video, is to show mechanically wise, it could happen. You can ventilate more than one person on one ventilator. And that's why I did the video. But then after that, people ran with the idea. And like I said, I think there's going to be several improvements in that concept.
Are there ways in which the pandemic has changed things for you in your personal life?
It has. I mean, I you don't really appreciate how easy it is to go out and do stuff on a whim, just because you want to. You know, the days that I'm not working, I'm pretty much at home. It has helped my housekeeping a little bit because I'm definitely doing some spring cleaning. It has helped me appreciate the simple time that you have with family that you can't do anymore. I find myself FaceTiming a lot more with my grandchildren and my children. And I, in the past, I just go over there and see them, and I can't do that anymore. So I think it helps me appreciate the simple things like just getting together with your family that, you know, is limited now.
We've started to think about what would happen in Michigan in the case of a second wave of COVID-19 infections. Based on everything you've seen and what you've learned the first time around, what do you think would happen if there were a second surge, either this summer or maybe in the fall or winter?
So I think that there's a lot we don't know about a second surge, and I think that's really almost like a black hole. It's like a vacuum of information that we just don't have. If we look back at the pandemic Spanish flu that happened in 1918, there was a horrible second wave. But if you read the accounts of those, that second wave, they felt that it was related to a mutation in that virus. With this virus, we really don't have any idea to forecast or predict. This virus is a lot like the human cold virus, and so even understanding if people who get it have long-lasting immunity is something we don't know. So I can't really venture to guess what could happen if a second wave happened, except to say that I think we'd be more prepared in terms of already having accumulated necessary resources that maybe some places didn't have when the first wave hit. So I think that that will be one thing that will be beneficial if a second wave does happen. But I think I'm with everybody else in the state just hoping and praying that that won't happen.
Yeah. I think a lot of us have thought about hospitals as the place where the most serious cases are ending up right now. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned this a little bit earlier. Some people have thought twice about going into the hospital. Is there anything that you would want people to know about hospitals right now?
So the hospitals are very good right now at making sure that we put people together that are potentially infectious and that we protect the healthcare workers. If you do need to come to the hospital, I would urge you to do so. If you have an emergency, I would hate to think of somebody staying at home having a heart attack or a stroke or something serious happening and they're afraid to bring their children or themselves into the hospital because other illnesses are still happening at the same rate. So I really think that people need to understand that the hospitals are very good at cohorting people that are possibly infectious and keeping people safe so that they don't catch an infection if they come in.
Have you seen anything changing with the availability of protective gear?
At our particular hospital, we have protective gear. I think they're currently trying different types of gears because the same brand, for example, may not be available all the time. So our hospital is very good about making sure that whatever gear we're using, it's tested for each individual to make sure that it will indeed protect them. We really haven't seen a lot of healthcare workers get sick. And I think it's because people are being very cautious and making sure that people do have the correct PPE that they need. I hope that continues.
What's getting you through the days right now?
What's getting us through that when I'm working, it's just seeing the patients and making sure that we are really careful about not touching our face and simple things like rubbing your eyes. You don't want to do that. So simple things like that, you have to be very cognizant of and make sure that you are super hyper acute about it. So when I'm working, I'm mostly focusing on taking care of the patients and making sure everybody is safe and everybody's doing proper PPE. When I'm home, it's a little bit different. I've pulled out some books. I've decided to read some stuff that I haven't had a chance to read in a while. And then I try to stay in touch with my family as much as I can.
Dr. Babcock, we really appreciate the work you're doing right now. Thanks for taking a couple minutes out of your day to talk to us.
Thank you very much for having me, and please be safe.
We've spent a lot of time over the past 6 weeks talking as a nation about who's most at risk of the most dire outcomes of COVID-19. Older folks, other adults with certain pre-existing conditions. Of course, we've all heard stories by now of young adults and otherwise healthy people succumbing to the virus's deadly effects. But what we haven't heard are many stories of loss of life for the youngest among us, our children, especially elementary-age kids. Horrifyingly, that changed this weekend. The Detroit News reports that a 5-year-old girl named Skylar, a vibrant and otherwise healthy little girl, came down with COVID-19. The virus resulted in an infection in her brain, and she died. Skylar was an only child living with her parents, both of them first responders in Detroit. That's our show for today. I'm April Baer. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.